Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Christian Science Monitor for Tuesday, September 2nd, 2025. And here are news briefs for today. Google avoided breakup in search monopoly case. A federal judge on Tuesday ordered a major overhaul of Google's search engine to curb its monopoly, but rejected the Justice Department's push to break up the company. The 226-page ruling requires Google to give rivals access to the query data that powers its results. It stopped short of banning the multi-billion-dollar deals the company has been making for years to lock in its search engine as the default on many devices. U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta also refused to force Google to sell its Chrome browser, Associated Press. Tennessee began requiring gun safety lessons for all K-12 students. Beginning this year, children will receive annual lessons on topics such as firearm parts, safe storage, and injury prevention without exposure to live weapons or ammunition. The law requires instruction to remain politically neutral, steering clear of debates over gun rights. Supporters argue the measure promotes safety, while critics question oversight, parental choice, and the absence of broader gun regulations. Staff. CDC is facing continued fallout. 9 former directors of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention rebuked Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for dismissing Director Susan Monraz, citing concerns over his approach to vaccine policy. In a New York Times opinion piece, they also criticized his earlier removal of a 17-member vaccine advisory panel replaced with members skeptical of vaccines. Mr. Kennedy Jr. responded in the Wall Street Journal, arguing that reforms are needed to restore trust by reducing conflicts of interest and focusing on transparency, innovation, and the agency's mission. Staff. AI chatbot makers to add new controls for teens. OpenAI and Meta said they are adjusting how their chatbots respond to signs of mental and emotional distress. OpenAI, maker of ChatGPT, said Tuesday it is preparing to roll out new controls enabling parents to link their accounts to their teen's account. Parents can choose which features to disable and receive notifications when the system detects their teen is in a moment of acute distress, according to a company's blog post that says the changes will go into effect this fall. The announcement comes a week after the parents of a 16-year-old sued OpenAI and its CEO, Sam Altman, alleging that ChatGPT coached the California boy into taking his own life, Associated Press. Congo's former justice minister jailed for corruption. A high court sentenced Constant Matumba to 3 years in prison after convicting him of embezzling $19 million in public funds. The money was meant to finance the construction of a prison in the northern city of Kisangani. Mr. Matumba was appointed justice minister in 2024 before he resigned over the case in June. He pleaded not guilty to the embezzlement charges. His case was seen as a flashpoint of the Congolese government's crackdown on chronic corruption that has stifled the country's development, Associated Press. Sudan appealed for aid after landslide. A landslide Sunday wiped out a village in the western region of Darfur. A rebel group controlling the area has said. The Sudan Liberation Movement Army said that initial information indicates the death of all village residents, or more than 1,000 people, with only one survivor. The group is appealing for international aid. Search teams struggled to reach the area because of bad weather and a lack of resources. Most of the Darfur region has become inaccessible for the United Nations and aid groups, given restrictions and the civil war between Sudan's military and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, Associated Press. Judge blocked Trump administration's use of troops in L.A. The administration violated federal law by sending troops to accompany federal agents on immigration raids. Judge Charles Breyer in Washington ruled. He did not require the remaining troops withdrawn, however. California sued, saying the troops sent to Los Angeles over the summer were violating a law that prohibits military enforcement of domestic laws. Lawyers for the Republican administration have argued the Posse Comitatus Act doesn't apply because the troops were protecting federal officers, not enforcing laws. Associated Press. Scholars said Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. The International Association of Genocide Scholars has around 500 members worldwide. 86% backed the resolution, which could serve to further isolate Israel in global public opinion. Israel rejects the accusation and says it only targets militants, blaming Hamas for civilian casualties because the militant group operates in densely populated areas. Associated Press. Our first article today is how the National Guard court ruling in L.A. affects Trump's plans for other cities, by Henry Gass and Story Hinckley. A federal judge ruled on Tuesday that the Trump administration's use of National Guard troops and U.S. Marines in California this past June was illegal. The deployment, ostensibly to protect federal property and law enforcement officers amid anti-immigration protests in the city, occurred over the objections of California Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom. In a 52-page decision, Judge Charles R. Breyer wrote that the duties assigned to the troops violated the Posse Comitatus Act, an 1878 law prohibiting the use of military personnel for domestic law enforcement activities. Presidents deploying the National Guard in a state over the objections of a governor has been rare in U.S. history. Nevertheless, President Donald Trump has suggested he might deploy National Guard troops in other Democrat-led jurisdictions, including Chicago. While Tuesday's ruling does not have any legal force outside of California, it could serve as a guide for how courts interpret National Guard deployments in other cities, experts say. And the ruling might make President Trump hesitate before deploying the National Guard to another city. The same Posse Comitatus Act and the same Constitution apply in Chicago and Baltimore and across the country, says Rachel Van Landingham, a former U.S. Air Force judge advocate. It's a clear shot across the bow to President Trump as a warning to not do something similar in other cities. In referencing other potential deployments, Judge Breyer described Mr. Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth as trying to create a national police force with the president as its chief. There is no question that federal personnel should be able to perform their jobs without fearing for their safety, the judge added. But to use this as a hook to send military troops alongside federal agents wherever they go proves too much and would frustrate the very purpose of the Posse Comitatus Act. Judge Breyer stayed his injunction until September 12th, giving time for the administration to appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. His ruling also stated that 300 National Guard members still in Los Angeles can remain in place as long as they're acting within the bounds of the law. The Justice Department declined to comment, and the Pentagon deferred to the White House. In a statement on Tuesday, Anna Kelly, a White House spokesperson, said that the ruling will not be the final say on the issue. Once again, a rogue judge is trying to usurp the authority of the commander-in-chief to protect American cities from violence and destruction, Ms. Kelly added, according to a social media post. The case appears destined to reach the U.S. Supreme Court, and some legal experts say the administration could have a strong case. In June, a panel of appeals court judges overturned an emergency order from Judge Breyer, pausing the deployment in Los Angeles, known as Task Force 51. The Trump administration will be seeking a similar outcome now regarding Judge Breyer's second ruling that the duties of those deployed violated the Posse Comitatus Act. Judge Breyer, the brother of a former Supreme Court Justice, Stephen Breyer, is a decidedly liberal judge who has issued many rulings against the Trump administration, says John Malcolm, a senior legal fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation. Most of them haven't fared well once they reach the courts of appeal, and I expect that here. The decision came after Judge Breyer held a 3-day bench trial in the case last month, featuring testimony from high-ranking officers involved in Task Force 51. At one point, the court saw a U.S. Army training slide describing what the Posse Comitatus Act prohibited National Guard troops from doing in Los Angeles. The evidence at trial established that defendants systematically used armed soldiers and military vehicles to set up protective perimeters and traffic blockades, engage in crowd control, and otherwise demonstrate a military presence in and around Los Angeles, wrote Judge Breyer. In short, defendants violated the Posse Comitatus Act. The Posse Comitatus Act restricts the use of the U.S. military domestically. It holds that members of the military can only engage in law enforcement activities on home soil with direct authorization from Congress. The law enshrined the constitutional principle that while the president is the commander-in-chief of the U.S. military, only Congress has the power to declare war and provide for calling forth the militia to suppress insurrections and rebel invasions. Congress had made it very clear that when a president can and cannot use military force in law enforcement domestically, says Joshua Kastenberg, a former lawyer and judge for the Air Force. In a sense, the administration has been their own worst enemy, he adds. The decision on Tuesday referenced three specific operations, three raids of marijuana and cannabis farms by federal agencies, all of which occurred outside the Los Angeles County. The government got greedy, says Professor Van Landingham, who teaches at Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles. They shot themselves in the foot and engaged in extreme overreach without the statutory and constitutional basis for doing so. Seemingly aware of this, Judge Breyer's ruling is narrow. The Task Force 51 deployment as a whole is not illegal, he held, but it prohibits military troops in California from engaging in law enforcement activities such as arrests, searches, seizures, riot control, and interrogation. The decision applies only to Secretary Hegseth and the Defense Department, not to Mr. Trump. The ruling is still flawed, says Mr. Malcolm. Other potential deployments that Mr. Trump has talked about, such as in Chicago, to address violent crime, might be on shakier legal ground. But in Los Angeles, the Heritage Foundation fellow adds, you had troops come in to help federal officials execute federal laws. President Trump was well within his rights to do that. The legal confrontation comes as Mr. Trump has escalated his rhetoric and his action around National Guard deployments. Last week, he signed an executive order creating rapid mobilization units in the National Guard to assist in quelling civil disturbances and ensuring the public safety. Then over the weekend, he criticized Illinois Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker in a social media post calling out violent crime in Chicago. He better straighten it out fast or we're coming, wrote Mr. Trump. Overall, the stakes appear to be ratcheting up as courts wrestle with another Trump-powered test of bedrock constitutional principles. Regardless of what courts ultimately say, I think this is concerning, says Greg Nunziata, executive director of the Society for the Rule of Law, a conservative anti-Trump organization. The use of the military for domestic law enforcement has profound risks, he adds. It should be something that the federal government does as a matter of last resort and great reluctance. Our next article is Nationalist Conservatives from U.S. and Europe Gather Touting Different View of Democracy by Simon Montlake, staff writer. During President Donald Trump's first term, his former advisor, Steve Bannon, set himself up as a convener and catalyst for right-wing populists across Europe. He vowed to spread the MAGA revolution and to sweep aside centrist parties that he said had sold out to global capital. But his showy efforts to build a durable coalition of populist conservatives failed to pan out. What has had more traction, though, is an intellectual-led movement to seed a particular brand of conservatism in Western democracies. National conservatives, or NatCons, prioritize the nation-state and safeguarding its traditions and culture over the promotion of democracy, free markets, and global alliances, marking a break with post-Reagan orthodoxy on the right. There is more appetite for state intervention in the economy. Falling birth rates are seen as a crisis. The National Conservative Conference, which started in 2019, has become an annual gathering for like-minded populists and nationalists from the U.S. and other democracies that takes place in Washington and European capitals. Now that Mr. Trump is back in the White House, its proponents wield power. Vice President J.D. Vance has been a regular speaker and attendee. Speakers at this year's conference in Washington, which starts September 2nd, include Tom Homan, Mr. Trump's border czar, and Russell Voigt, his budget director. Republican Senator Josh Hawley, a NatCom regular who opposed the GOP's cuts to Medicaid, is also speaking. NatCons are just one faction, albeit a powerful one, in Mr. Trump's political coalition. The nationalist and populist right has been on an upswing in Europe, including in Germany, France, and the Netherlands. Reform UK, a party led by Trump ally and Brexit campaigner Nigel Farage, who is speaking at this year's NatCon, is leading the polls in the UK, and the populist right is challenging for power even in the smaller countries, like Portugal, which haven't seen the large influx of migrants that NatCons see as a destabilizing force in larger countries. Mr. Bannon's efforts to unite Europe's populist parties may have been too early, but the cross-fertilization of conservative thought at NatCon offers a parallel track in democracies that are now facing similar social challenges, says Rusty Reno, a theologian and editor of First Things, a religious and cultural journal. The West is in a time of disintegration of institutions and loyalties. National conservatism prioritizes a shoring up and renewal of national solidarity. So it's not surprising that you're seeing the same impulses in different countries, although, of course, they take different forms, says Dr. Reno, who helped to craft NatCon's statement of principles in 2022. The parameters of national conservatism and its policy prescriptions are somewhat fuzzy, deliberately so. NatCon styles itself as a big tent movement in which conservatives may differ on the public role of religion, for example, but not on the need for greater civic cohesion. It's often easier to say what it's against: mass migration, woke universities, Davos and other global power centers. Yoram Hazani, an Israeli-born scholar who helped start the conference, has called it an alliance of anti-Marxist liberals, Christians, and nationalists. Despite Mr. Hosni's mention of liberals, the NatCon project is in many ways a repudiation of liberalism, particularly in economic and social policy, says Angelos Chrysanegloos, an associate professor of politics and international relations at London Metropolitan University, who studies populist ideologies. Instead, the focus is on building a new politics of conservatism that isn't tethered to libertarian or socially liberal ideas. Many national conservatives have come to consider that liberal democracy is a system, as a system, is probably not fit for purpose anymore, at least for the interests and the culture of the West, and they're working towards creating some alternative, he says. Last July, Mr. Vance, who was about to be formally named as Mr. Trump's running mate spoke at NatCon in 2024 about what made America a nation. In his speech, he said the liberal belief that America is a nation based on abstract ideals and principles, such as the Declaration of Independence, was wrong. America, he said, is a group of people with a common history and a common future. If this movement is going to go anywhere, and if this country is going to thrive, we have to remember that America is a nation. As vice president, Mr. Vance defended the far-right AfD party in Germany during the national elections in February. His speech in Munich earned rebukes from German politicians who had sought to box the AfD out of power, a strategy that Mr. Vance derided. It was an example, say analysts, of how U.S. foreign policy, which had been anchored in the promotion of democracy and free markets, has morphed into the promotion of a MAGA social and political agenda. Some conservative leaders in Europe felt uncomfortable with the more religious right-infused policy of the previous Republican administrations, said Mr. Eric Kaufman, a professor of politics at the University of Buckingham in the UK. Trump's republicanism is much closer to the populist right that we see in Europe, which is focused on immigration and secular and cultural conservative concerns, and not really about democracy promotion, he says. That doesn't mean populist parties are seeking his endorsement. It's generally a liability outside the U.S. to be associated with Trump, says Professor Kaufman, who spoke at NatCon in London in 2023, and is the author of several books on nationalism and identity. Even Mr. Farage, who campaigned last year with Mr. Trump, tries to play down their association. In Canada's election in April, Mr. Trump proved he had to be a lead balloon for conservatives seeking to unseat a struggling liberal government. Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre, who styled himself as a populist outsider, lost the election and his own parliamentary seat after Mr. Trump threatened Canada's sovereignty to put tariffs on its trade-dependent economy. This speaks to the tensions inherent in efforts to build bridges between conservative nationalists who all want to put their own country first. Tariffs have become a zero-sum battle in which the U.S. leverages its economic might, reminding voters in smaller democracies why belonging to the European Union, which nationalists attack as undemocratic, is advantageous. It's one reason why the organizers of NatCon have built a broad church for their movement that sidesteps uncomfortable questions about trade protectionism and relations with Russia, says Professor Chrysogelos. As president, Mr. Trump has embraced a more interventionist role in the economy than have most democratic administrations, taking or seeking government stakes in private companies such as U.S. Steel and Intel, and setting prices for U.S.-produced rare earth minerals. Trump administration officials have said the government could take stakes in other companies. U.S. conservatives have traditionally lauded the unfettered free market as a source of U.S. strength and dynamism. In contrast to a leftist vision of state-led development that keeps capitalism in check, conservative radio host Eric Erickson described the Intel deal as socialism with an R next to its name. Mr. Reno says policy unorthodoxy is what makes national conservatism a viable alternative to what he sees as excessive liberalism and economic openness that has hollowed out Western societies. Preserving social capital is more important than breakneck economic growth. I think we're pivoting towards a politics of solidarity, restored solidarity, and that's why some aspects of the NatCon right seem to look like the old left on economic policy, he says. To Dr. Reno, Mr. Trump's re-election was a victory for national conservatism, one that could shift the weight of the political thought across the West towards a reconciliation of nations. He didn't didn't run on limited government. He ran on Make America Great Again, he says. Judge bars Trump administration from deporting Guatemalan children for now. The judge ruled Sunday after their lawyers said the youngsters were loaded onto planes in violation of laws affording protections for migrant kids. The judge in Washington says the children need to be taken off the planes while the legal process plays out. By Valerie Gonzalez and Rebecca Santana, Associated Press. A U.S. judge at least temporarily blocked the government Sunday from deporting a group of Guatemalan children who had crossed the border without their families, after their lawyers said the youngsters were loaded onto planes overnight and in violation of laws affording protections for migrant kids. Attorneys for 10 Guatemalan minors ages 10 to 17 said in court papers filed late Saturday that there were reports that planes were set to take off within hours for the Central American country. But a federal judge in Washington said those children couldn't be deported for at least 14 days, and after a hastily scheduled hearing Sunday, she enforced that they needed to be taken off the planes and back to the Office of Refugee Resettlement Facilities while the legal process plays out. I do not want there to be any ambiguity, said Judge Sparkle L. Spooknen, who said her ruling applies broadly to Guatemalan minors who arrived in the U.S. without their parents or guardians. Government lawyers, meanwhile, maintained that the children weren't being deported, but rather reunited at the request of their parents or guardians, a claim that the children's lawyers dispute, at least in some cases. Similar emergency requests were filed in other parts of the country as well. Attorneys in Arizona and Illinois asked federal judges there to block deportations of unaccompanied minors, underscoring how the fight over the government efforts has quickly spread. The episode has raised alarms among immigrant advocates, who say it may represent a violation of federal laws designed to protect children who arrive without their parents. While the deportations are on hold for now, the case underscores the high-stakes clash between the government's immigration enforcement efforts and the legal safeguards that Congress created for some of the most vulnerable immigrants. At the border area airport in Harlington, Texas, the scene Sunday morning was unmistakably active. Buses carrying immigrants pulled into the tarmac as clusters of federal agents moved quickly between the vehicles and waiting aircraft. Police cars circled the perimeter, and officers and security guards pushed reporters back from the chain-link fences that lined the field. On the runway, planes sat with engines idling, ground crews making final preparations as if departures could come at any moment. All as the courtroom battle played out hundreds of miles away in Washington. Shaina Aber of Acacia Center for Justice, an immigrant legal defense group, said it was notified Saturday evening that an official list had been drafted with the names of Guatemalan children whom the U.S. administration would attempt to send back to their home country. Advocates learned that the flights would leave from Texas cities of Harlington and El Paso, Ms. Aber said. She said she'd heard that the federal Immigration to Customs Enforcement officials were still taking the children, having not gotten any guidance about the court order. The Department of Homeland Security, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the Department of Health and Human Services did not immediately respond to requests for comment on Sunday. The Trump administration is planning to remove nearly 700 Guatemalan children who came to the U.S. unaccompanied, according to a letter sent Friday by Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon. The Guatemalan government has said it is ready to take them in. It's another step in the Trump administration's sweeping immigration enforcement efforts, which include plans to send a surge of officers to Chicago for an immigration crackdown, ramping up deportations and ending protections for people who have had permission to live and work in the United States. Lawyers for the Guatemalan children said the U.S. government doesn't have the authority to remove the youngsters and is depriving them of due process by preventing them from pursuing asylum claims or immigration relief. Many have active cases in immigration courts, according to the attorney's court filing in Washington. Although the children were supposed to be in the care of and custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, the government is illegally transferring them to Immigration and Customs Enforcement custody to put them on flights to Guatemala, where they may face abuse, neglect, persecution, or torture, argues the filing by attorneys with the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights and the National Immigration Law Center. An attorney with another advocacy group, the National Center for Youth Law, said the organization starting hearing a few weeks ago from legal service providers that Homeland Security investigators agents were interviewing children, particularly from Guatemala, in Office of Refugee Resettlement Facilities. HSI is ICE's investigative arm. The agents asked the children about their relatives in Guatemala, said the attorney, Becky Wolozin. Then on Friday, advocates across the country began getting word that their young clients' immigration court hearings were being canceled, Ms. Wolozin said. Migrant children traveling without their parents or guardians are handed over to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, where they are encountered by officials along the U.S.-Mexico border. Once in the U.S., the children often live in government-supervised shelters or with foster care families until they can be released to a sponsor, usually a family member, living in the country. The minors can request asylum, juvenile immigration status, or visas for victims of sexual exploitation. Due to their age and often traumatic experiences getting to the U.S., their treatment is one of the most sensitive issues in immigration. Advocacy groups already have sued to ask courts to halt new Trump administration vetting procedures for unaccompanied children, saying that changes are keeping families separated longer and are inhumane. Guatemalan Foreign Affairs Minister Carlos Martinez said Friday that the government has told the U.S. it is willing to receive hundreds of Guatemalan minors who arrived in the U.S. unaccompanied and are being held in government facilities. Guatemala is particularly concerned about minors who could pass age limits for the children's facilities and be sent to adult detention centers, he said. President Bernardo Arevalo has said that his government has a moral and legal obligation to advocate for the children. His comments come days after U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem visited Guatemala. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. Cooking videos got these Gazans a global following. Now there's nothing to eat, by Gahada Abutalafa, special contributor. For more than a year, Renad Atala's Instagram cooking tutorials offered an unusual window into the life in Gaza Strip. On Renad from Gaza, that's at RENADFROMGAZA, the giggly 11-year-old explained to her 1.6 million followers how to cook hamburgers with the canned meat from an aid parcel. In another video, she quipped at the drones buzzing overhead as she explained how to make a banana roll the Gazan way. It looks like the drone above us likes cream. That's why it's out, she joked. As basic ingredients became increasingly scarce in Gaza, Renad improvised, mashing cooked pasta to make bread. But Renad's popularity isn't due only to her made-for-social media cuteness. With foreign media excluded from Gaza and local journalists regularly killed on the line of duty, social media has become one of the few windows still cracked open into life in the besieged territory. Through the eyes of Renad and other content creators, the conflict's devastating effects on civilians play out in real time. It's not about views. It's not about comments, Renad said. It's about the truth of our lives. And the truth now is that Palestinians in Gaza are starving. In late August, United Nations agencies warned that close to 100% of people in Gaza are facing a hunger crisis, and one in three will experience famine, meaning catastrophic conditions characterized by starvation, destitution, and death by the end of September. On Instagram, Renad's followers watched Gaza's hunger crisis unfold on a human level. Her round cheeks thinned as she dropped more than 10 pounds. Dark circles bloomed around her eyes. Famine bread, the Gazan way, she announced at the beginning of a recipe tutorial in early June, her face uncharacteristically serious. The video was a far cry from the spunky earlier posts on @Renada from Gaza. Renad and her older sister, pharmacist Nordam Atala, started the page together in March of 2024 after a video showing Ms. Atala's personal account of Renad opening a box of donated food from the United Arab Emirates got more than 9 million views. With Ms. Atala behind the camera, the sisters made videos of Renad cooking and unboxing aid parcels, a riff on influences elsewhere in the world who film themselves opening their online purchases. "I can't talk because of excitement," Renad exclaimed in one early video as she sliced open the tape on a box from the charity Human Concern International. As she lifted a bag of meat slices from the parcel, an explosion sounded in the distance. Renad flinched and then continued to gleefully pull items from the box. Hamada Shakura also knew how to catch the eye of faraway viewers. Before the war, he owned a marketing agency and used his Instagram account, HAMADASHOO, to promote Gaza City's thriving food scene. As he sampled local taco joints and filmed families tucking into pizzas and burgers, Mr. Shakura's page offered a glimpse of a city vibrant despite years of Israeli blockade. "Food is a universal language of expression," he says. In early 2024, he began posting his own wartime cooking tutorials using ingredients sourced from aid parcels. The clips were wordless, but like Renad's, they spoke a global language. Mr. Shakura's videos featured quick cuts of him preparing a dish, the amplified sounds of his chopping, pouring, and sizzling, creating a popular effect known as ASMR. He, too, soon went viral, becoming known for his unbroken, somber gaze and creative takes on international dishes such as tacos, pizza, and crepes. At first, he shared his culinary creations with children at a makeshift camp in Rafah, near where his own family was living after fleeing their home in Gaza City. But as his Instagram following grew, Mr. Shakura connected with local and international charities providing food to displaced people. Soon, his videos showed him preparing meals by the thousands for those in need. "What made it meaningful was feeding people," he says. "Seeing that others could eat because of my cooking, it gave value to everything." As the war groaned on, however, posting about food slowly began to lose its joy for both Renad and Mr. Shakura. They themselves rarely had enough to eat, and when they did, it felt crass to flaunt what they had while others around them starved. "It wouldn't be right," Renad says simply. After she posted her famine bread video in early June, she did not make more recipe tutorials. Instead, she began sharing posts with titles like "Foods I Haven't Tasted in 5 Months" and "We Are Being Starved." Mr. Shakura, too, has largely stopped updating his account. "It's impossible now," he explains. "I cannot cook for others when I struggle to find food for my wife and child." Even when he has donations, he says, he is afraid to distort the already exorbitant prices in local markets by buying up large quantities. "That would harm the whole community," he says. But not being able to cook for children weighs heavily on him. "Cooking is a meal for a child who has nothing is about more than food," Mr. Shakura wrote recently in Time magazine. "It's about telling them that they matter and that they are not forgotten." Meanwhile, Renad's life was changing quickly. Her elder sister won a scholarship to study at Maastricht University in the Netherlands, and at the end of August, she, Renaud, and Renaud's twin brother, Adam, were evacuated from Gaza. On Renaud's Instagram page, the sisters made a new post. It was a solid black background with a single word, goodbye. And now commentary by the Monitor's editorial board. A post-shooting light on prayer as action. After the Minneapolis school tragedy, many Americans have acted with compassion, urging new gun laws as well as seeking comfort and guidance through spiritual listening. Last week's tragic school shooting at Annunciation Catholic School in Minneapolis saw hundreds of Minnesotans coming together to support the affected individuals and families and each other. They did this through small acts of commemoration and kindness, such as candles, flowers, and thanks to teachers and emergency responders. They also gathered in larger groups, in parks and places of worship, seeking to heal heartbreak and find ways to prevent a recurrence of the violence that killed two children August 27th. 18 other children and 3 adults were wounded in the attack during a mass to kick off the school year. At a Sunday service at Annunciation Church, the Reverend Dennis Zaharin urged parishioners to cling to their faith amid darkness and grieving until a little light starts to dawn. That, he said, is what we wait for, what we welcome. Since the shooting, however, a political firestorm has ensued in the wake of the comments by those impatient for greater action on gun control. These are kids that should be learning with their friends. A visibly shaken Minneapolis mayor, Jacob Frey, told the press after the shooting, they should be able to go to school or church in peace without the fear or risk of violence. Don't just say this is about thoughts and prayers right now. These kids were literally praying, he said. The political right is now accusing the left of diminishing and disrespecting religious practice. The left contends thoughts and prayers is a platitude to disguise inaction on weapons access and use. Yet, the dispute sets up a false dichotomy between political activism and the notion of prayer as passive acceptance. It would obscure the fact that a substantial portion of Americans rely on prayer for comfort and practical spiritual action. According to the 2025 Pew Religious Landscape Study, prayer is a part of life for more than 60% of Americans, with 44% saying they pray daily. I believe prayer works because it changes us. The Reverend Shannon Johnson Kirshner of Central Presbyterian Church in Atlanta told CNN last week. Prayer gives us the vision to see everyone as God's beloved, she said, and then it motivates us into acting that out in a way we live our lives around and use our resources. Father Zaharin shared this prayer-rooted vision Sunday. There is no darkness that God can't bring life from. There's no sorrow that God can't spring joy from, he assured the congregation. Russia accused of GPS jamming flight of EU leader von der Leyen over Bulgaria. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen's plane landed safely at Plovdiv Airport. President von der Leyen, a fierce critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin and Moscow's war in Ukraine, is on a 4-day tour of European Union nations bordering Russia and Belarus by Sam McNeil and Valentina Petrova, Associated Press. A plane carrying European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen was hit by GPS jamming over Bulgaria in a suspected Russian operation, a spokesperson said Monday. The plane landed safely in Plovdiv Airport in central Bulgaria, and President von der Leyen will continue her planned tour of the European Union's eastern frontline nations, said Commission spokesperson Ariana Podesta. We can indeed confirm that there was GPS jamming, said Ms. Podesta. We have received information from the Bulgarian authority that they suspect that this was due to blatant interference by Russia. The incident with President von der Leyen's plane is the latest in a series involving suspected Russian electronic interference with GPS satellite navigation. For months, countries bordering Russia, including Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, have warned of increased electronic activity interfering with flights, ships, and drones. Russian authorities did not immediately reply to requests for comment. President von der Leyen, a fierce critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin and Moscow's war in Ukraine, is on a four-day tour of much of EU's eastern flank, with stops in Lithuania, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Poland, Romania, and Bulgaria. This incident actually underlines the urgency of the mission that the president is carrying out in the frontline member states, Ms. Podesta said. She said that President von der Leyen has seen firsthand the everyday challenges of threats coming from Russia and its proxies. And of course, the EU will continue to invest into defense spending and in Europe's readiness even more after this incident, she said. Bulgaria issued a statement saying that the satellite signal used for the aircraft's GPS navigation was disrupted during President von der Leyen's flight. She was traveling from Warsaw, Poland, to Plovdiv, Bulgaria's second-largest city, in a private jet chartered by the European Commission. As the aircraft approached Plovdiv Airport, the GPS signal was lost, the statement said. It said that Bulgaria's Civil Aviation Authority instructed the pilots to use backup navigation aids to land the plane. The Associated Press has plotted almost 80 incidents on a map tracking a campaign of disruption across Europe blamed on Russia, which the head of Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service has described as staggeringly reckless. Since Moscow's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, Western officials have accused Russia and its proxies of staging dozens of attacks and other incidents, ranging from vandalism to arson and attempted assassination. The interference from Russia includes jamming and spoofing. Jamming means a strong radio signal overwhelms communications, whereas spoofing misleads a receiver into thinking it is in a different location or in a past or future time period. In August, Latvia's Electronic Communications Office said it had identified at least three hotspots for jamming along borders with Russia. In April 2024, a Finnish airline temporarily suspended flights to the Estonian city of Tartu following jamming, while in March that year, a plane carrying the British Defense Secretary had its satellite signal jammed as it flew near Russian territory. The office said that although Russia maintains the jamming is defensive, the frequency has increased as interference extends further from Russia's borders. Pilots and air traffic controllers from Sweden to Bulgaria are reinventing the old-school methods of navigating because they cannot rely on GPS anymore, said Eric Schouten, an intelligence analyst and CEO of Diami Security Intelligence based in Utrecht, the Netherlands. He reported on the rise of an autocrat, then he had to flee his country, by Nelson Rauda Zabla, special contributor. It all happened too fast. I was sitting in a coffee shop in Guatemala City with fellow journalist Jose Luis Sanz, drinking a passion fruit and cardamom frozen drink. As usual, we had stored our phones in our backpacks in order to speak freely. It had been 4 years since we both discovered they had been tapped by Pegasus, a spyware sold only to governments. When Jose turned on his phone, he showed me a message he had just received from another colleague. A source warned us that the Attorney General's office in El Salvador was preparing 7 arrest warrants against members of the newsroom for crimes related to gangs. The message had a list of names. I saw mine. 3 days earlier, we had published an investigation at El Faro, a leading investigative outlet in Central America, and it was going viral. I'm El Faro's digital content editor, and Jose was the editor of the English section until 2024. In a 3-part video interview with gang leaders, El Faro detailed the deals they had been making with the government of El Salvador and how these deals gave gang members protection from government crackdowns. They should have been in jail, but instead they were talking to us, airing out their grievances from a negotiation that went sour, frustrated by how the government has publicly denied these talks ever took place. Our video detailed the secret deals. We thought it would be scandalous. We thought the government would say we were collaborating with gang members because we agreed not to disclose the location of the interviews. We knew it would be dangerous, and that's why four of us left El Salvador before publishing the three-part series. Over the years, such departures had become standard security practices for journalists. We call them preemptive exits, a euphemism, because we never know what dangers exactly we're hoping to avoid. El Faro was founded in the years following El Salvador's civil war, and it has been publishing independent investigations since 1998, under right-wing and left-wing governments. I've worked there for the past decade, but government pressure has increased since President Nayib Bukele took office in 2019. Within 4 months, El Faro journalists were banned from news conferences. Then came online harassment by Mr. Bukele and his officials. In subsequent years, El Faro journalists were spied on and subjected to criminal investigations for fabricated accusations of sexual harassment and a money laundering investigation that includes four ongoing audits from the finance ministry. Charges have never been formally brought to court. Two foreign colleagues who entered the countries legally as tourists were denied work permits and had to leave. El Faro moved its administration to Costa Rica in 2023 to ensure the Salvadorian government wouldn't seize its assets. But we persisted as reporters in El Salvador. We all lived in the capital, San Salvador. We have families, cars, mortgages there, even if now we speak of our city in the past tense as something far away. I walked out of the coffee shop in Guatemala City, stunned. I got a cab to drop me a few blocks from where I was staying. Walking gave me a chance to think about how I was going to tell my wife and the rest of my family that I couldn't return home. I was angry about my lack of foresight, having packed only a carry-on. I thought I would be back to my apartment in a week, tops. We left towels drying on a rack and food in the fridge. I had watered my plants just enough. I left on April 30th. I don't know when I will be able to return home. I know it won't be soon. Our travails are not exceptional. Hundreds of journalists go into exile every year from places such as Ukraine, Hong Kong, Nigeria, and Venezuela. Reporters Without Borders tally of exiled journalists in 2023 was 460, likely an undercount and more than double the number from 2022. It's also part of a global political upheaval. For the first time this century, there are more autocratic leaders in the world than democratic ones, according to this year's Varieties of Democracy, or VDEM, report. From Hungary's Viktor Orban to Russia's Vladimir Putin to Nicaragua's Daniel Ortega, the ideal of democracy as an aspirational form of political organization is crumbling. And with it, the protections for civil liberties and human rights are weakening, regardless of a country's wealth, geographic location, or history. The idea that democracy is a form of government that always has ample popular support is basically a leap of faith, says Jose Antonio Aguilar Rivera, a professor of political science at the Center for Economic Research and Teaching, known as CIDE, in Mexico City. Public support for democracy in Latin America dropped in 2013 and has yet to recover. There's a sense that democracy hasn't delivered on its hefty promises of upward economic mobility or access to education, experts say. And in places like El Salvador, the population has openly supported this shift away from democratic norms as a sort of shortcut towards improved public security. The actual meaning of democracy is changing, say experts such as Molly Cohen, an assistant professor in the political science department at Purdue University. In Venezuela, under Hugo Chavez, we saw people start to associate democracy with him. They approved democracy because it had produced this president who was giving them what they wanted, Dr. Cohen says. When citizens are getting what they want, democracy is performing for them, she says. The idea is shifting to become an indicator of support for the leader rather than these vague ideas of institutions and rules. What happens when citizens are no longer getting what they want, but all checks on power have been removed? I've come to realize that once that sort of power comes knocking on your door, it's already too late. May was the month for the great exile in El Salvador, the biggest exodus of political exiles since the Civil War, according to Los Angeles Times report of more than 100 journalists and human rights activists who have fled El Salvador as Mr. Bukele continues to jail his critics. In June 13th statement, the Salvadorian Journalists Association, known by its Spanish acronym APES, said it documented the forced displacement of approximately 40 journalists from the country following multiple cases of harassment, intimidation, and arbitrary restrictions against journalists and media outlets. But it was activists who bore the brunt of the crackdown. Between May 12th and May 18th, three human rights defenders were arrested. Pastor José Ángel Pérez and lawyers Alejandro Henriquez and Ruth López. Ms. López was one of the most prominent voices denouncing corruption in the government. Mr. Pérez and Mr. Henriquez were assisting a group of campesinos fighting eviction from their farmland with legal and spiritual support. All three of them were declared prisoners of conscience by Amnesty International, which means they were deprived of their liberty solely because of their beliefs. They didn't advocate violence or hatred, only due process, respect for the Constitution, and the rights of communities. These detentions are not isolated events. Agnes Camillard, Amnesty International's Secretary General, said in a statement, they are part of a systematic pattern of criminalization that seeks to silence those who denounce abuses, demand justice, and demand transparency in public administration. It's the first time El Salvador has had prisoners of conscience since the end of its civil war in 1992. The effects of the clampdown are still reverberating. Guillermo Cartagena, a young journalist who covered the joint trial of Mr. Pérez and Mr. Henriquez, reported that three uniformed police officers knocked on his door June 25th, inquiring about basic utilities and the number of people who live in the house, according to APES. The officers stayed in the alley for more than an hour before asking questions to anyone else in the neighborhood, Mr. Contega observed. He left his home that day. And that's all the time we have for today's reading. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.